Gravity had a good run, but it's time to feel the weightlessness of the Brooks Glycerin 21. These running shoes feature nitrogen-infused DNA Loft V3 cushioning. Brooks has even magnified the plushness to elevate the softness to new levels. And if you want extra support, find these same features in the Brooks Glycerin GTS 21. Learn more and shop now at brooksrunning.com. That's brooksrunning.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Republicans head to the White House for a chat about a potential bipartisan infrastructure deal, while progressives are urging President Biden not to waste time. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. On Monday, a handful of Republicans, including perhaps most notably Mitt Romney, were in the Oval Office to talk with President Biden about his proposed plan for about $2 trillion in infrastructure spending, with infrastructure defined pretty loosely. But it does seem like there's an appetite among some in the GOP for a counterproposal in the range of $600 billion to $800 billion focused on those traditional steel and asphalt projects. Here's what Texas Senator John Cornyn said over the weekend. There's a core infrastructure bill that we could pass, so let's do it and leave the rest for another day and another fight, unquote. Kim, what do you make of that, and what do you give the odds of that kind of a deal?
Well, John Cornyn wasn't one of those at the White House. You had, as you mentioned, Mitt Romney, also John Hoeven, who's a senator from North Dakota, Kay Granger, who's a House member from Texas, and Carlos Jimenez, who's also a Republican from Florida, from the House. Those were the four Republicans. There were about five Democrats there. And yes, supposedly the discussion centered on doing a traditional infrastructure bill. So that would be roads and bridges, possibly also broadband, more like $600 billion to $800 billion, and potentially with a different financing deal, maybe some sort of user fees or an infrastructure bank. Or one proposal is to try to force better tax compliance. The argument is that there are hundreds of billions of dollars that go wanting every year because the IRS doesn't take care of loopholes, etc. And, you know, both sides are going through this process because Biden administration obviously has said that they want bipartisanship, and the Republicans who attended are those that have expressed interest in working on the other side. I think the problem with all of this and why the likelihood of this is still very low is that likely anything smaller like this would get maybe the support of a small group of senators and House members in the middle, but probably still wouldn't get support from the vast number of very liberal members who want something much bigger, or very conservative members who think that even this would be too much money, especially if it involved raising taxes in any way. So can you really forge a coalition here? I also am not convinced the Biden administration is willing to go small and that this is more going through the motions, but we'll see where it ends up. I think that that's going to require some actual policy and outlines of policy before we'll know its prospects.
But on the point of willingness to go small, it's been interesting to watch as each side sort of jockeys for a better position as the negotiations begin, that one of the ideas on the Democratic side is, why don't we just take yes for an answer and do the roads and bridges as part of a Republican bipartisan deal. And then later we can spend the other $1.2 trillion through reconciliation process with only 50 votes in the Senate. I mean, Delaware Senator Chris Coons is saying that explicitly. You know, why don't we do this? Why don't we take the $800 billion and go get the $1.2 trillion later? But Bill, from the Republican standpoint, it seems to me if the position from some of those guys like Mitt Romney is $2 trillion is too much, we don't want to raise the taxes needed for that, then part of the impetus for them to negotiate a smaller package is to head that off. And if Democrats are taking that away by saying, we're just going to do the other $1.2 trillion later, it seems to me there's a much less desire among the Republicans to do that deal.
I hope so. I hope there is less of a desire. I'm not persuaded about that. I think you've identified the progressive logic here. Look, real bipartisanship is that you have an issue and you come together and you give and take on it. It's not you give and take on, you know, one quarter, one third of a bill, and then you come back and you ram the rest of it through without the support, without any support from the other side, and especially if they do it through reconciliation and so forth. It really does suggest a bad faith here. And I'm hoping the Republicans stand firm, because if they agree to a roads and bridges part, which they might be able to justify this, you know, this for my district and so forth, as you say, the larger logic is to get the full Democratic wish list while also getting credit for being bipartisan. And I think the only weapon they have is not to to make clear this is Joe Biden's unilateral agenda. He has no interest in genuine bipartisanship, and stick them with their agenda. This sort of gives them cover, and it doesn't accomplish, as you point out, it doesn't accomplish really anything if you just put off the spending in another bill and have it come through another way. That's not a compromise. That's just dividing it up, and we'll do this part together to get some cover, and then we're just going to go on our merry way with the rest of it.
Right. And so part of the question here is whether I think the Democrats, President Biden, really is willing to compromise and take that $2 trillion number down below $2 trillion. But the other side of the argument on the Democratic side is not, you know, President Biden shouldn't waste his time with this negotiation. People like Senator Sheldon Whitehouse are making this case. Here's what Bernie Sanders said recently. "I personally don't think the Republicans are serious about addressing the major crises facing this country. Maybe I'm wrong, but we're certainly not going to wait for an indefinite period of time," unquote. And so, Kim, there you're not detecting much interest in negotiating at all.
Yeah, and that's the view of the vast majority of the Democratic Party. And I think the important point to remember here is that so far, that's the portion of the party that has called all the shots. You know, I remember that singular moment, I think, during the last debate between Biden and Trump, in which he was accused of basically being more of a radical socialist, just a puppet for Bernie Sanders. And he said, "No, you know, this is Joe Biden's party and I'm going to have my own views." But you know what? So far, we have yet to see him really show those. This Joe Biden, well, I think it's actually always been Joe Biden, is serving more as a vessel for the ascendant wing of his party, which is very much a progressive wing. And as a result, has had to engage in some, you know, verbal gymnastics to try to suggest that he nonetheless is the bipartisan figure that he claimed to be when he was getting elected. You know, one of the things that he's been doing is talking about how what bipartisanship is, basically redefining that. Now, according to Joe Biden, bipartisanship is when you have like 52% of the country supports your legislation or your proposals, including a couple of Republicans, and that shows you have Republican support. That in no way has ever been the traditional definition of bipartisanship, which is where you bring along the elected representatives of those Americans in Congress to work with you on something. So I am convinced that this progressive wing is still going to be calling the shots. And when you have Joe Biden inviting historians in to, you know, glorify him with comparisons to FDR, you definitely get the impression the White House is thinking about only transformative big projects and that they're not going to be satisfied with the $600 billion infrastructure deal.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kim brings up an interesting point here on the definition of bipartisanship and the Biden White House's attempt to shift that a little bit. And the encapsulation is this quote, I believe from the Washington Post, a senior White House advisor, Anita Dunn, says this. She says, if you looked up bipartisan in the dictionary, I think it would say support from Republicans and Democrats. It doesn't say the Republicans have to be in Congress, unquote. And so the theory, Bill, I gather, is that something, just to take the COVID bill, for example, that there's some polls that show that it has some support among Republicans. And so that counts as bipartisan. I don't know, Bill, what about your dictionary?
Look, my dictionary is the classic one. I don't think you can have something bipartisan, call a piece of legislation bipartisan if it doesn't get bipartisan votes, just pure and simple. We're seeing a lot of redefinitions. You know, we're seeing pre-K labeled as infrastructure and all sorts of things labeled as COVID relief when they weren't. And, you know, one of, I think, the many scandals going on is that the Biden administration is impressed on this. I think if Trump tried some of these ridiculous things, it would be front page news. He'd be hammered on it. But they're letting it pass from Joe Biden. The classic definition is bipartisan. You get people across the aisle to come with you on a vote. They're either not able to do that, or I think more likely they don't care about doing that. They care. I think they read the narrow majorities they have in the House of Representatives and the Senate as an indication that they have only a less than 2-year window to get everything through that they wanted. Now, you can argue that it's a bad precedent for them and they may come to rue the day, you know, as they did on judicial nominees and the filibuster. But that is, I believe, how they see it. That's how they're acting. And while they may talk about bipartisanship, I don't think it's part of the agenda at all.
My other thought on the question of the definition of bipartisanship, Kim, is just that this, if this is how we're talking, then this cuts both ways. And there are a lot of things that Republicans have favored that look very, very bipartisan when you define it that way. And one of them is voter ID laws. I checked some of the polling this morning. In 2018, there was a Pew Research Center study that said 76% of Americans want voters who go to the polls that be asked to show a government ID, and that includes 63% of Democrats. Yet if you tried to make an argument that was a bipartisan bill, Kim, I think you'd hear some words from Joe Biden.
Yeah, and you can go down the line. There are plenty of polls talking about what people would desire, for instance, in terms of a good voting practices. Most voters also agree, for instance, that you need to require absentee ballots to be received by Election Day. Most people believe that you should have stronger verification of absentee and mail-in ballots. And so are all of those bipartisan ideas? Absolutely, at least under Joe Biden's definition. So, you know, the White House might want to be careful about how it is using that dictionary. And just in general, I think that gets to something that we began talking about. You mentioned that a lot of Republicans are going to be wary if Democrats are essentially going to change the rules of the game. Let's say you go out and you get this smaller bill and then they just jam through everything on the back end and raise the corporate tax hike that you'd already taken off the table with the infrastructure bill, et cetera. You can't have real bipartisanship if people aren't playing by the same set of rules. And, you know, Bill used the word bad faith. And if that bad faith continues to exist and you have Chuck Schumer constantly threatening to use reconciliation again and again or break the Byrd rule or end the filibuster or whatever it is, Republicans won't be able to operate in good faith. And it raises the prospect, too, that, again, on this redefinition, that when Republicans come back around, they're going to use all of those broken rules themselves. And it's just something Democrats should be wary of and think hard about as they go forward.
And another data point for these Republicans who are thinking about an infrastructure deal and are asking themselves whether President Biden is really interested in negotiating with them Another data point is the COVID deal, Bill. And there was a group of 10 Republican senators, which is enough to break the filibuster, who went to the White House on February 1st and pitched a $600 billion bill. Remember, Biden wanted $1.9 trillion. And they said they thought they were acting in good faith. And the next day, the Democrats in the Senate moved forward on this $1.9 trillion budget resolution to pass their package through reconciliation. And it was interesting. We had a little bit of a spat on the history of that recently when Biden said, he said from his perspective, those Republicans, Bill, they just didn't want to compromise with him.
Right. I think that was actually, just to be Machiavelli, a big mistake on the Democrats' part, even for the assuming that your goal is to just push through your agenda. That would have been the easiest way to get credit for bipartisanship, to have a real deal that didn't spend as much money, but you would have got a lot of Republican votes for that. It would have been less money altogether. But I think having less money, you know, maybe it would be half the size of the bill that they had. They would have established a record at the outset of being bipartisan, and it would have put the president in the position, look, I was bipartisan on this, I'm willing to do it, but the Republicans are being obstinate. Instead, they took the easy out, you know, the hell with you. We're just going to ram through what we want. We're not in the business of making any compromises or adjustment. And I think that was a big political mistake for them. Kim's alluded to this before. The irony of what they're doing is also making it easier for the Republicans to unify. I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans that would like to vote for some parts of this infrastructure and so forth. But if the Democrats continue to be so high-handed, it makes it easier for the leadership to consolidate his forces and get people to stick together. So the irony is, I think they're creating a counterforce here that they didn't have to create.
And the sticky part is always not the spending, not agreeing to build some roads and bridges, but figuring out where that money is going to come from and how to pay for it. And Kim, it seems that the conversation around the corporate rate, which is 21% right now, Biden says he wants it to be 28%. It seems that the debate is settling in around 25%. I mean, is that a gain from some of this negotiation between Republicans and Democrats?
I suppose so. It's certainly better than 28%. And that number seems to be coming from the fact that it's what Joe Manchin has suggested would be his preferred corporate tax rate, or at least the number above which he does not want to go. You know, it's not what it is now. And you can argue over whether or not splitting the difference or coming down 3 percentage points is that big of a gain. What you also have are Republicans now offering counter proposals to raising corporate taxes. You also have some Democrats talking about those as well, too. One of them is, for instance, to instead, because this is an infrastructure bill, and often the way we pay for infrastructure is through things like user taxes. So people are talking about a gas tax or higher gas tax, I should say, or a vehicle mileage tax. I think one of the problems that Republicans would have with that, though, is it's kind of dicey politics. It's very easy to imagine a lot of Democrats accusing Republicans of not wanting to raise corporate taxes on big corporations, but more willing to impose new taxes on average Americans out driving. So there's a little bit of political danger there. People have also talked about tax compliance, and like I mentioned earlier, trying to make sure there's a way that the IRS recoups more of its tax money that is currently being sucked away from tax shelters or loopholes. One of the problems with that, in my mind, is it's always a bit of a gimmicky way of conjuring up money, saying, oh, we'll just have government do a better job and then we'll have more money there. Presumably, if it was easy to do it, we would have done it already. Lately, you've also heard talk of an infrastructure bank, and it's unclear exactly how that would work, but it also seems a way of potentially helping pay for some of this without necessarily just pure outlays. So we'll see where these proposals go. But you can bet that there's going to be a lot of demands for progressives to simply raise that corporate tax rate, because for a lot of Democrats, that's not just a way of raising money, but it's a philosophical desire as well, too.
Right. And the Republican position on the gas tax or some kind of user fee like that, I mean, I imagine it's an economic argument. And essentially, it's that is tied in some way to the money that we're spending. And so the money is being raised from the people who are benefiting from the creation of those roads and bridges. And that, you know, people also see the tax. That's the other thing, Bill, that sticks out to me is it's easy to for politicians to say we'll just raise the rate on big corporations and not think that there are any downstream economic effects from that, because they're sort of hidden in the economy in the way that the gas tax isn't. You see the gas tax at the pump.
Exactly. And people see the differences. You know, there are a lot of people that cross state lines and go to different parts of the state, different parts of the country to get gas because of the prices. Yes, it's something that people can feel, and politicians, of course, hate that when they're raising taxes. I personally think the gas tax, especially at the state level, has been so misused. The principle, as you say, if it's applied to roads and bridges and so forth, the principle seems sound, that, you know, the people that use these things should pay for it. I'm more for user fees and so forth. And I frankly would go further. I believe that, you know, with the state that our bridges and roads are in, I do believe it could be funded with tolls and so forth, you know, by the people that use them, but we're so far from there. And the dilemma now is how to sneak in taxes where people don't rebel.
The other thought, the other point that I thought was worth making on the corporate rate is one that was made by Kevin Hassett, the former Trump economic advisor, in an op-ed in the Journal a week or two ago. And he points out that raising the corporate rate to 28% may sound like it's not very much, since it was 35% before the Trump tax reform. But his argument here, I'll just give you a flavor of it. He says, the base broadeners that financed the rate reduction in 2017 aren't being reversed. They're being enhanced, meaning that there are fewer loopholes. There are fewer untaxed dollars. And so, Kim, he says that by revenue, taking the rate to 28% now would be five times bigger than taking the rate from 35 to 21.
Right. An enormous part of that entire bill. And there, a lot of time was put into thinking this through. And it wasn't simply about cutting that rate from 35%. It was about ways to simplify the tax code, both on the individual side and the corporate side, and to broaden the base. So to make sure that fewer corporations had the ability to wiggle out of paying taxes, in a way to make the system, I think better word is, and I Democrats love this word, but, you know, more fair and easier to comprehend, and therefore to encourage tax compliance and also to capture revenue. And if you get, you know, if you just raise the rate, you're taking away part of the fundamental deal that was implicit in that, which is more people are going to pay, but at a lower amount. And I think the other mistake that Democrats are making here is, you know, that they've got all kinds of ideas about how, if they impose this new corporate tax rate, they would at the same time impose these new rules that would penalize or make it harder for companies to move offshore. But one of the fundamental reasons for also having a lower tax rate is you want to encourage new capital to come in, and as a process, and foreign companies to come, you know, base themselves here and go public on our stock exchanges. And one of the great downstream effects, as you put it, that is that you encourage more domestic capital creation. And these are all things that are potentially at risk if you start bumping that rate back up again. And, you know, Democrats are saying, well, you know, we're not taking it all the way back up to 35%, but even 28% would be among the highest in the developed world again.
And then you also have this group of Democrats from blue, primarily high tax states, who are also saying that if there's any changes to the tax code in here, we're not going to vote for it unless it also restores the full federal deduction, unlimited for state and local taxes. And Bill, that's enormously expensive. It takes a lot of tax dollars to do that. But here, there's New York's Jerry Nadler has an argument for this. In a tweet, here's what he said. He said, no one should ever be taxed twice on the same income. It's not fair and it's not just, unquote. What do you make of that argument?
Well, the Democrats excel at trying to get people to tax them twice on the same income. You know, capital gains, all sorts of things that Democrats are for. What they don't like about this was a tremendous reform in the tax code, because what you have is that the high tax states like ours, you know, New Jersey, the lower tax states are somewhat subsidizing them, because people here, we get to deduct the our federal taxes, you know, from our federal income tax. And what that does is gives the states that tax very high more leeway to tax that. Like, people don't feel it quite as much. And that's what they hate. They're really being exposed. And it's extraordinary to me on this SALT reform, which I think was one of the biggest parts of the tax code and the tax reform. What's extraordinary to me is that in all the reactions you see among blue state politicians, you never, ever hear the answer, well, maybe we ought to reduce the tax, the overall tax burden on our citizens. Instead, they want all sorts of gimmicks so that they can continue their merry way. And this has proved the only thing that is making them feel the pinch. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. You know, Joe Biden has sort of conflicted interests here, because as head of the federal government, you know, this would mean restoring that deduction would mean a lot less federal revenue at a time when he's, you know, his spending is through the roof. So it will be a very interesting battle to see whether whether these Democrats who say they're not going to vote for the bill without a SALT restriction, without the SALT provision lifted, whether they mean what they say.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.